وَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا. You see, whoever takes Allah, the messenger, and those who believe. Here Allah is explaining this wali, simple, one individual in history, وَلِيكُمُ اللَّهِ. The wali, that Allah says, your wali, who is also the wali of Allah. That's why we in Adhan and Iqama say, أَشْهَدُ أَنَّ عَلِيًّا وَلِيُّ اللَّهِ. People ask, why do you say that? It is from the Quran that Allah has taken him as his wali. That's the wali here, though the verse is talking about guardianship, not friendship. So here you find that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, whoever takes Allah and his messenger and those who believe, meaning Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, these are from the party of Allah known as Hizbullah. And they are the successful ones. Subhanallah.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Everything has been carefully planned for the annual New Year's greetings ceremony to the king. Government officials are all standing in line to perform the tradition of kissing the king's hand. But it seems someone special is absent from the ceremony. Iran is shocked and stunned with the news of a suicide. The suicide of well-known Qajar commander, Colonel Fazlullah. No one knows how the Prime Minister was notified of what had happened, but everyone saw his hasty exit from the New Year's greeting ceremony. The first person who arrives at the scene is then Prime Minister Vosukhodole. His presence at the Colonel's house is not that strange. What's strange, though, is that he personally inspects the scene and does not issue the burial permit until the discovery of the Colonel's letter before he committed suicide. It's now 9 days since the beginning of the new year, but the colonel's suicide has still not been reported to the public. Finally, after 10 days, Vosukh allows the coverage of the event, but only Ra'ad newspaper is allowed to publish it, without mentioning a motive for the suicide. You have to look for the answer to the riddle in the note that the colonel had written before killing himself. What is the motive of the suicide? Why does Vosukh prevent the publication of the news? The answer to these questions invites us to an exciting journey, a journey among historical records and documents.
Media outlets which support the government try to circulate word that the suicide had a personal motive, and on the other hand, Vosu Kotole has peace of mind that the people and media do not have access to the colonel's last letter. Until a document discovered at the mortuary shatters all of Bosuk's calculations. A note soaked in blood in Colonel Fazlullah's shirt pocket. This document proves rumors that the suicide of Colonel Fazlullah and the agreement were related. Of course, it wasn't very difficult to confirm the connection. Less than 2 months since the publication of the agreement has passed and the British delegation enters Tehran. A delegation led by this man, General Dixon, an experienced officer in the British Army. Their mission has been defined, the establishment of a committee for the implementation of this article of the agreement. An article which lifts military sanctions on Iran and insists that it establishes a uniform military force. The meetings of the committees are held at this place with the presence of Colonel Fazlullah as the representative of Iran's army. During 4 months of talks, issues like the purchase of weaponry, of course from India's army, the unification of military forces, and the training of Iranian officers are discussed. But the results of lifting of the military sanctions is the purchase of light and used weapons remaining from World War, something that creates disagreements within the committee. The disagreement slowly turns into a problem when another issue is mentioned. It goes so far that Colonel Fazlullah is harshly confronted by the then Minister of War. This is what lies at the heart of the issue, the training of Iranian officers. It is approved that a number of sergeants will train Iranian officers, but these sergeants will not be coming to Iran from England, but from the Indian Army. And the officers can only be promoted to the rank of captain. Higher ranks must only be employed from the British Army. The colonel is faced with statutes that weaken Iran's army, something totally against the agreement. A familiar theme for the people of Iran, a difference between the text and essence of the agreement. The same had happened during the Goldsmith Treaty, the Paris Treaty, the Treaty of Turkmenchay, the Treaty of Golestan, and others. The colonel's objections are useless. He's chosen another way to make his voice of opposition heard. Suicide. Even though the colonel committed suicide only with the knowledge he had of the agreement's third article, he unveiled the oppressive nature of the agreement. That started the first of the protests and created an atmosphere which allowed the agreement to be exhaustively scrutinized. This is how Sayyid Hassan Mudarris voices his criticism of the agreement. Things become so heated that nationalists and religious forces come together in opposing the agreement. Mohammad Mossadegh, using the keyword deception, begins to criticize the agreement. Nationalistic fervor soon reaches the southwest of Iran. The protests are centered here, in Tabriz. The bazaar is shut down by shop owners, schools are closed, and after scuffles, the gendarmerie is now under the control of the people. The leader of these protests is Sheikh Mohammad Khiabani, a well-known figure in Iran's political landscape. Vosu Kotole's defense of the article gives the British the permission to employ their own people and infiltrate in any part of the government that they deem noteworthy. The protests in Tabriz are followed here by the founder of the jungle movement, Younes Ustad Sarayi, known as Mirza Kuchak Khan Jangeli. In his newspaper called The Jungle Paper, he refers to the agreement as a document to sell Iran. This agreement also has monetary obligations.
The people have to pay from their own pockets for the British to oppress them. Of course, it is framed as a loan to Iran in order to achieve articles of the agreement, which include employing the British in the government and the purchase of their used weaponry. This is how Abdullah Mostofi, the writer of the book, The Story of My Life, refers to the loan. Mirzadeh Eshqi criticizes the fourth article in the form of a poem. The agreement also has a solution for the improvement of public transportation in Iran. England generously agrees to it, to allow Iran to have a railway system. This article can be considered positive and in line with the development of Iran. But why does Iran even need the consent of England to have a railway system? And the basics of choosing a contractor for national projects is soliciting tender offers, not imposition by a certain country. In the last article of this agreement, England wants to free the customs services, an organization that is under their own occupation. Even if this article leads to its release, it is nothing but bargaining over an irrefutable right. As the protests continue, Farrukhi Yazdi also uses poetry as a sword to oppose the agreement and addresses Vosuq. But it's not only Farrukhi Yazdi and Mirzadeh Eshqi who use literature as a weapon to criticize the agreement. Yahya Dolat Abadi, Dehkhoda, Malik-ush-Shu'ara Bahar, and even Iraj Mirza write poems and contents in their opposition to the agreement. Of course, there was a price to pay for those with a critical pen. Mirzadeh Eshqi and Farrukhi Yazdi are imprisoned because of their poetry. Ordinary people joined the National Solidarity Movement by staging shutdowns and walkouts, sit-ins in mosques and streets, and unite against the agreement. This is Sheikh Abdul Hussein Mosque, the center of the protests in Tehran. In a controversial act, Vosuq orders an attack on a gathering at the mosque and 17 prominent figures are arrested. It seems as if Vosuq has lost control of the situation. Sepah Square is near the mosque, and even the heavy rainfall cannot stop the people of Tehran from staging huge protests. Iran is drowning in the fury of the people. Protests are held in every single corner of the country. Everyone, regardless of their party and group affiliations, with any political and religious belief, is protesting against the agreement. Every single one wants only one thing, the annulment of the agreement. The signing of a secret agreement which was meant to lift sanctions and spin the wheels of the economy and politics in Iran showed its true colonial nature with the suicide of Colonel Fazlullah. The agreement now faces the widespread opposition of the people from every party, class, and status. It's an agreement that is bitter, but not the only one of its kind in Iran's history, which has been full of ups and downs. But it seems this agreement is somehow different from the ones before it. If only this was the end of it. Unfortunately, the story of the agreement does not end here. A sad story and its ending chapter is written not in Tehran, but somewhere 4,400 kilometers away, in a place in the Green Continent. A developed city with the River Thames flowing through it. It's exactly here, London. Not too far from the Big Ben Clock Tower, the editorial office of the Times. This is the exact location where the last page of the agreement is, in the newspaper's archives department. Among the masses of paper, an interesting headline can be seen. The headline of the agreement between Iran and England. What can be seen following the title is the details of the agreement. Details that are not very different from what we already know. But this newspaper reveals a huge mystery of the agreement for the first time. The answer to the mystery is not in its headline or the body of the article, but hidden in the top of the page. Exactly here, on top of the page, where the date of the paper is printed. August 16, 1919, which falls on Mordad the 24th, 1298 on the Iranian calendar. Take a look at the date of the publication of the agreement in Iran, the 17th of Shahrivar, 1298, which falls on September 9, 1919. The difference is obvious. This means that the agreement was signed at least 24 days before it was made public in Iran. But here's the question. When the agreement has already been signed, what was being negotiated during those 24 days? What delays the negotiation process? The answer can be found in this telegraph from British ambassador to Tehran. It seems what prolonged the negotiations was not the text of the agreement. The agreement has annexes too, and the bargaining was over these annexes. The closest I got to becoming successful in this mission was lowering the asking price to 400,000 tomans. To be fair, I must inform you that when it came to asking for money, Vosukhodole was not as unrelenting as the other two ministers, Nosratodole and Saremodole. They truly made life a living hell for me. It seems we have to accept a reason for the negotiations taking so long. A bribe. Years later, the bribe is attacked in an editorial in the Times by the opposition of the British government. We persuaded the Anglophile government of our own creation in Iran, and with the help of a bribe of £130,000 stolen from the British taxpayer, we wanted to popularize the Anglo-Persian agreement. The British people did not know about the bribe, but the Iranian population did. Aside from clarifying the sum of the bribe, the editorial also includes a bitter confession. The confession to the creation of an Anglophile government in Iran by the British themselves. In the court of history, these documents are witness that it was the British who caused the famine. The British who brought Vosukhodole to power and by sending Ahmad Shah off to Europe were busy colonizing Iran based on a completely calculated plan. The savior of Iran is the blood of Iranians like Colonel Fazlullah. A tragedy is a writing or a play which has a sad theme and usually showcases miseries, physical and mental torture and betrayal. After a century, we talked about the tragedy of the Anglo-Persian Agreement of 1919. But how will history narrate the future tragedies of Iran?
علم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked in
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant factor.
امامت یک اصل زنده است در تاریخ اسلام.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu Alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
که این صفت مخصوص زن نیست، اما چرا حضرت برای زنان خواسته؟ چون
chastity and honor is not limited to women only. However, Imam al-Mahdi in a supplication asks Allah to give women such attributes. But why? This is because if a woman is deviated in a society, the whole society will be deviated. Thus, if a woman in society is deviated, the man of that society will be deviated too. The moral downfall of the women will make a society deviated too.
زن اصلا محور تربیته. همونجور که در خانواده محور تربیت هست.
Woman is the pivot of moral nurturing in both family and society. If a woman is deviated morally, then the man is deviated too. That's why all our infallibles, especially Imam al-Mahdi, ask Allah to give the women of a society the sense of chastity and honor. This way, a society can develop spiritually too. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Opinion polls in the United States are suggesting a late surge in support for Trump-endorsed nominees who have embraced his lie about election fraud. Many believe that a Trump victory in the midterm elections would tighten his grip on the Republican Party. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. The BBC has more for us. The final opinion polls of the midterm elections are out and can help give us an answer to the question on everyone's mind: who will win, Democrats or Republicans? Indications are that the Republican Party is on the verge of taking back control of the US House of Representatives for the first time in the past 4 years. The upper chamber of Congress, the Senate, remains too close to call. There are more paths to a Republican victory in the Senate than for Democrats, who have held the barest of majorities there for the past 2 years. Understanding how it could unfold in both chambers is just a question of mathematics. In the House, Republicans need to flip only 5 seats out of the 435 in the chamber to have a majority. According to the Cook-Putkill report, which analyzes the competitiveness of races based on polling data and underlying election dynamics, Republicans are favored in 212 seats. They would have to win just 6 of the 35 races listed as top-ups to control a majority. 10 of those seats are already held by Republicans. The 100-seat Senate is somewhat simpler to understand. Only 35 seats are up for election this year, and there are only a handful of closely contested races. A net change of just 1 seat towards the Republicans will swing the chamber to them. Given that Democrats are trying to protect more seats than Republicans, there are simply more ways for Democrats to lose the Senate than to win it. That gives the Republicans the upper hand, albeit by the narrowest of margins. It appears likely that Republicans will control at least one chamber of Congress once the dust has settled and these midterm elections. After 2 years of unified Democratic control in Washington, the power dynamic in the nation's capital is poised to shift. Here are 4 very real implications for American politics for the next 2 years. Although it unfolded in fits and starts, after 2 years in office, Joe Biden and the Democrats were able to enact a fairly substantive legislative agenda. It included massive spending on the environment, on healthcare, and other social programs. But all of that will end with a Republican victory on Tuesday, 8th of November. There's the chance of bipartisan cooperation on some issues. For instance, Republicans and Democrats did join together to pass gun control and technology investment legislation this year and infrastructure spending last year. However, the kind of big-ticket liberal priorities on abortion, education, and voting rights will be dead in the water. Republicans have their own legislative agenda, with particular focus on border security, law enforcement spending, budget cuts, and fossil fuel extraction. Even if they take both chambers of Congress, Democrats will be able to block passage in the Senate using the filibuster rule, or in the White House using Joe Biden's veto power. The British newspaper The Guardian has more for us. The spectre of Donald Trump's imminent declaration of a new White House run looms over races in several key states. Ahead of Tuesday, 8th of November's midterm elections, where the former president poised to seize on any success for ultra-conservative candidates as validation for his 2024 presidential campaign. Opinion polls appearing to reflect a last-minute surge of support for Donald Trump-endorsed nominees in a number of crucial congressional and governor's contests came as the former president appeared at a rally for the Republican Senator Marco Rubio in Florida on Sunday. Heaping praise on an incredible slate of true MAGA warriors, Trump cited his Make America Great Again political slogan. Some of his preferred extremists, including Kerry Lake in Arizona, Herschel Walker in Georgia, and J.D. Vance in Ohio, have erased Democratic leads to reach Election Day as favorites, according to the polling website 538. Other Trumpist Republicans who once trailed by double digits, including the Senate candidates Mehmet Oz in Pennsylvania and Blake Masters in Arizona, have closed to within touching distance, giving their party hope of recapturing the chamber and providing Donald Trump a significant lift as he prepares to declare his third run for the Republican presidential nomination. If this is a big night for Republicans, and they think it's going to be, that will be a major, major victory for Donald Trump, and his followers will be greatly energized, said David Gergen, a White House advisor to 4 presidents. If they come up with anything like that kind of victory, if they turn 2 or 3 of the seats in the Senate, they control the House, it's going to be hard to stop Trump within the Republican Party. He will be, in effect, the very likely nominee. Most of the so-called MAGA candidates have amplified Trump's lie that his 2020 election defeat by Joe Biden was a result of electoral fraud. A Washington Post analysis last month found that 291 Republican nominees in Senate, House, or statewide races, more than half of those running, have denied or questioned Donald Trump's defeat. Democrats fear that the tightening of races in which Donald Trump-endorsed candidates are running will prompt them to follow the former president's tactics and claim fraud if they lose. Joe Biden expressed the worry at a rally in New York on Sunday in support of the Democratic governor, Kathy Hochul, who is facing an unexpectedly tough battle with Republican Lee Zeldin. These deniers are not only trying to deny your right to vote, they're trying to deny your right to have your vote counted, President Biden said. I'm not joking. For these election deniers, there are only two outcomes for any election. Either they win or they were cheated.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini l-Islami, dini wal-Azam, ghayru dini, Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to deal with an important subject of hijab according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But let's listen to a short biography before we start our program. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, They said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Gloss on RIB English Radio with me, Mahaj Awad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about hijab with Sheikh Javid, and some of the questions quite related to the issue of women, for example, driving cars. Sheikh Javid, what's the Islamic law about a woman driving a car?
Well, according to His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, there is no problem there's no objection to a woman driving a car. So it is, generally speaking, and according to Shia scholars, let alone Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, of course, all Shia religious authorities, including His Eminence Ayatollah Khamenei, are of the view that that a woman can drive cars, it's permissible.
I see. Sheikh Javid, I want to ask you a very important and rather interesting question regarding women's dress in front of their mahrams. All right? We always talked about, in fact, women wearing this and that, or, for example, wearing hijab in front of, non-mahram, non-marriageable people, right?
Yes.
Or strangers, let's say. But what about in front of the mahram? What do women, or what should they wear? And what do you advise the women to wear, in fact, in front of their mahram relatives, in front of other women, for example, in their family gatherings and weddings, for example, or ceremonies?
Well, modesty is not only about going out and wearing clothes that are modest. Modesty means that one should be careful about his behavior, about his clothes. And when it comes to a woman, she should be careful about the dress she wears. She should not uncover her attractive parts, even if she's in front of her close relatives, like brothers, like father, and children, of course. That's why Islam says, for example, that when a brother and sister wants to sleep, it is necessary that they sleep in different rooms. And especially if it is feared that they might fall into a sin, they should sleep away from each other. Now, if it is very much likely that one of them might fall into a sin or into a haram act, then it is mandatory for them to sleep, separately from each other. They should sleep in separate rooms. When it comes to observing hijab, of course, the clothes should be modest and should preserve a woman's dignity and a woman's dignity, respect as a believing woman. As a believing woman, she should wear proper clothes. She should not, uncover herself. She should not, when when she is actually in front of her children or her brothers or father-in-law and so on and so forth, now she must dress herself properly, and list the other family members or the male members of her family should not fall into a sin.
Mm-hmm, I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a very short break and we'll be back and continue our questions around the very important subject of hijab. And in this program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. And the subject is hijab. Well, Sheikh Javid, you know, some people, some women actually, have beautiful or melodious voices. Yes. All right? And they are sometimes asked by the family members, in fact, to sing in front of them, for example, in some gatherings, yes, right? So some of them even recite poems during birthdays and mourning ceremonies. Some of them recite, or they are asked to recite, for example, du'as or the Quran in a place where non-mahram cannot hear them. So what's the ruling on this issue?
So the assumption is that non-mahram cannot hear them, mm-hmm, okay? In the event that non-mahram cannot hear a woman reciting poems or reciting the Holy Quran or supplications or maybe, you know, singing a religious song, there is no objection to her, you know. It is permissible according to His Eminence, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei.
Right.
But if she knows that there are non-mahram men outside and listening or hearing her voice, then it's not permissible to make her voice soft, attractive, and, you know, sweet, you know, and charming, and because it is going to cause those men to fall into a sin or get attracted. And therefore, she can recite and she can, for example, if she's reciting or if she's going to recite du'a or the Holy Quran, she can recite without making her voice attractive or pleasant or sweet or something like that.
Uh-huh, I see. So when it comes to reciting the du'as and the Quran, even in front of the non-mahrams,
she can recite without making her voice, you know, delicate, mm-hmm, attractive, sweet,
just
and
normal
soft
recitation.
Just like, for example, when she speaks to a non-mahram, you know, how does she speak? She speaks in a normal way without making her voice attractive, you know.
Yes.
The same is the case. She can recite the Quran without making her voice very much or attractive, you know, or delicate or something,
right,
tender, soft.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, Sheikh Javid, another question, you know, somehow in a similar vein. When a person dies, a funeral ceremony attended by men and women alike are held in a courtyard, and a literate or educated woman sometimes recites the Quran and offers condolences in the women's gatherings, with men present in the same place hearing her. So what's the religious law about this?
Well, I haven't, you know, seen such thing. Maybe this is very much, this could be a customary,
mm-hmm,
or something, a tradition practiced in some Arab Muslim countries. So generally speaking, a woman cannot, you know, recite in a melodious, in an attractive voice, anything, including the Quran, in the presence of men, in the presence of women. Of course, if no man is there and no one and no strangers is going to hear her, there is no objection to reciting something or reading something out loud, and either in the form of condoling or extending her condolences to the family members, to the grieved ones, or in the form of reciting the Holy Quran. Mm-hmm. So it depends on how she recites the Quran and how she may be offering her condolences in the presence of other people, men or women.
Mm-hmm. Shoshavit, a very quick question regarding the limits and restrictions regarding a woman's chat or her interaction with sister's husband and a brother-in-law. What are those restrictions or limits?
Well, a woman's conversation with non-mahram men should be without flirtation and without lustful intention. And she must understand that, for example, the example you give that the sister's husband is non-mahram,
mm-hmm.
and she's just like any other man outside the family, and therefore she is not to be treated as someone who can see her without hijab, who can see her without proper clothing. That's not the case. So the sister's husband remains non-mahram, and therefore it's very much necessary that observes that she is careful about her voice.
Mm-hmm.
And generally speaking, a woman's voice is in and of itself is not aura. It's not something to be hidden. The woman's voice in itself, there is no objection to it. So it's not forbidden for a man to hear the voice of a non-mahram woman, unless, of course, it's done with the intention of lust or seeking pleasure or, enjoying and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the answer.
I think. Thank you very much, Sheikh Tawheed. Thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم ملجا لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو رحيم محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.